frequently lead to binge eating. A trigger can be anything from a feeling of loneliness to having a fight with a boyfriend to eating a piece of chocolate cake to drinking alcohol to being stressed out about an exam. Through self-monitoring, I attempted to learn my triggers for my binges so that I could eliminate them from my life or develop healthier ways to handle them. If I dealt with all of my triggers, my binge eating was supposed to subside or at least become markedly less. However, no matter how well I managed my triggers, the urges to binge didn't go away. Through self-monitoring, I discovered, for example, that I often binged in my dorm or apartment alone at night. So I labeled being alone at night a trigger for binge eating. Because of this, I often tried to avoid being alone at night, and if I did have to be alone, I made detailed plans of things I could do instead of binge. Even with the best laid plans and coping strategies, though, I still usually experienced urges to binge, and I still binged. I'll discuss triggers in more detail in Chapter 35, but for now, know that without urges to binge, it would be nonsensical to say that triggers cause binge eating. Every day of my recovered life, I experience many of the things that supposedly triggered my binges in the past. But those things do not trigger binge eating today. This is not because I've somehow learned to avoid or cope with every imaginable trigger. I think it would have been impossible to discover everyone and learn to cope properly with all of them. Trigger hunting was a needlessly time-consuming and complex process, and it helped me blame my behavior on many other things besides my own free choice. Like psychodynamic therapy, CBT was an indirect way to approach my problem. But at least in CBT, I did learn two techniques to try to confront my urges to binge: substitution and distraction. Substitution involves trying to decipher the negative feelings surrounding the urges and substituting positive activities to cope with those feelings. When I got an urge, I first tried to determine what feeling had brought it on. Then I attempted to deal with that feeling. So if I determined that I had an urge because I was feeling stressed, then I did some relaxation techniques, like deep breathing or taking a long bath, to try to counteract the stress. The problem was it was naive to think that some breathing exercises or a bubble bath was going to take away my urge to binge. After all, my body and brain were not strongly urging me to deep breathe or bathe. They were screaming for food. No technique I ever used to deal with any of the feelings I thought caused my urges ever satisfied me. Because, as I've said, there are no substitutes for binge eating. Even if I did manage to find a plausible emotional reason for my urge to binge, and even if I did manage to substitute a healthy activity, it usually didn't change the fact that I wanted to eat. Furthermore, it was rare that I actually mustered up the willpower to even follow the recommended process. My urges to binge were so uncomfortable that I usually couldn't think about anything else, much less determine what I was feeling and how I should deal with it. I believe the substitution technique was actually harmful to me. When I did manage to use it, it caused me to focus all my attention on the urge to binge in an effort to decipher its symbolic meaning. And that served to give my urges even more attention and emotional significance, even more power. Attention and emotional significance given to thoughts and feelings are like winds to a fire, making those thoughts and feelings more intense. This happens on a physical level in the brain. The neural connections that produce attended thoughts and feelings become more active, more organized, and stronger. Focusing attention on the urges was counterproductive. What I really needed to do was stop giving the urges any attention, emotional significance, or power. The second CBT technique for dealing directly with binge urges, distraction, involves simply engaging in any distracting activity until the urge passes, without necessarily trying to determine the negative feeling or emotions behind it. Suggestions include doing something with the hands, like cleaning or sewing, or listening to music. Patients are often told to keep lists of 10 or more things they can do instead of binging when the urge arises. In CBT, just delaying binge eating for a little while is considered progress. I created many lists of distracting activities, but it never worked in the long run. If I could marshal enough willpower to do something else besides head to the refrigerator or nearest convenience store, then yes, distraction could delay my binges for a time. But the urge often did not go away, and even when it did, it would return as quickly as it had subsided, usually less than an hour later. It seems to me that the mindset I needed to distract myself often compounded the problem. It's like the saying, if you tell someone not to think about a pink elephant, the first thing they think about is a pink elephant. In the same way, trying not to think about wanting to binge made me think about wanting to binge even more. So once again, by attempting to distract myself from binge eating, I effectively gave my thoughts and feelings more attention, fortifying the faulty neural pathways that produce them. There are many other CBD techniques, such as behavior management programs, which reward healthy behaviors, and contracts, which require patients to sign agreements to refrain from binge eating for a certain amount of time. I signed contracts with myself to make it through a certain number of days. And sometimes I did make it through that many days, but rarely more than 4 or 5. I tried rewards for getting through a certain number of days without binge eating, like treating myself to a new CD or a movie. The problem was the part of my brain that drove binge eating didn't want a new CD or a movie. It wanted food, lots and lots of food. During an urge to binge, it was as if my animal brain laughed at the idea of getting a new CD, because after all, what use did it have for it? I, my human brain, wanted the new CD. But when it, my animal brain, was in control, thinking about rewards for my true self did nothing to deter me. Although CBT is considered the best and most successful form of therapy for binge eaters, it does not help everyone. Research has shown that CBT eliminates binge eating and purging about 30 to 50% of patients. Binge eaters who do recover using CBT often have the type of recovery I described in this book's introduction as the tamed house pet story. CBT can produce the one day at a time type of recovery, wherein the patient must perpetually stay on guard against triggers, follow a meal plan indefinitely, and constantly keep her moods and negative feelings in check to avoid relapse. Ideally, the daily struggle to remain in recovery will get much easier over time, and the eating disordered behaviors may even go away completely, but not without continuous effort. Addiction treatment. Addiction treatment, if it is effective, also produces the tamed house pet or day-at-a-time type of recovery. Addiction treatment is based on the idea that the foods a binge eater typically binges on, usually foods high in sugar and carbohydrates, are psychologically addictive. To recover, the binge eater must abstain from those addictive foods, often indefinitely. A patient using this approach maintains recovery one day at a time by diligently avoiding the problematic foods, because theoretically, even a small amount of sugar or carbohydrate-laden food could lead to a binge or even full-blown relapse. Of the three approaches we've discussed, addiction treatment is the least often used in treating bulimia, although it is sometimes used in conjunction with the more traditional psychodynamic and CBT approaches. Addiction treatment is more often used to manage BED and compulsive overeating. I tried abstaining from sugar and white flour at various times during my bulimia, but this never lasted more than a day or two, and I found that complete abstinence compounded the problem. Denying myself all sugar and white flour seemed to send my animal brain into overdrive and caused me to crave those substances even more. Even those without eating disorders have cravings for any pleasurable foods that they try to eliminate from their diets. And my brain was likely more defensive than the average person's because of my past restrictive eating. My animal brain saw any form of food restriction as a threat and therefore reacted by producing urges to binge on the very foods I tried to eliminate. While there is some evidence to back up the theory that some foods are addicting, this does not mean that eating those foods causes binge eating. If sugary foods were truly addictive and truly led to a loss of control in binge eating, then I would have binged every time I ate sugary foods, but I did not. There were certainly times during my bulimia when I ate a few cookies, one piece of cake, or a few chocolates and didn't binge. The urges to binge, not the sugary foods, caused me to binge. When urges to binge arose as I ate sugary foods, and I immediately gave in and followed those urges, it was easy to think that the sugary food caused the binge. It indeed felt like I couldn't control myself around sweets sometimes. However, there is no evidence of biologically based loss of control in bulimia, and the loss of control that binge eaters feel is only a perceived loss. Bulimics have control over their behavior, regardless of what foods they eat. The problem is, bulimics, myself included, for many years, don't know how to exercise that control. Giving up the foods that seem to cause loss of control is, in effect, avoiding the problem. It may cut down on some urges to binge, but it only ensures that when those foods are reintroduced in the future, the urges to binge will return. Giving up certain unhealthy foods, like sugar and flour, can be a worthwhile lifestyle choice with many benefits. However, it should not be a requirement for stopping binge eating. It is too difficult, unnecessary, and it can create a perception of powerlessness that can become self-fulfilling. If a binge eater believes that certain foods will inevitably lead to binges, those foods will most likely lead to binges. Empowering the pattern. The three approaches I've discussed in this chapter are not the only therapies used for treating bulimia and BED. Just the most prevalent and the ones I was exposed to during my own treatment. There are other types of therapy, such as pharmacological therapy, music therapy, art therapy, hypnosis, meditation, and acupuncture. However, these less common modes of treatment are usually used alongside one of the three main approaches. There is substantial variation with each approach and between therapists. The therapeutic techniques, nutritional protocols, and medications are different for each patient. There is currently no simple cure for bulimia or BED. I believe this is because traditional treatment approaches do not correctly define recovery or the cause of binge eating. Because recovery is defined to include such goals as resolving one's past and developing one's identity, as in psychodynamic theory, coping well with daily stressors and overcoming negative thinking, as in CBT, and giving up certain foods, as in addiction therapy, it becomes a complex, time-consuming, and often confusing process. Also, because traditional treatment approaches assume that a multitude of other things, such as underlying issues, triggers, and problematic foods, cause binge eating, these therapies miss the real problem, the urges to binge. And sometimes even worsen that problem. Shortly after I stopped binge eating for good, I read a book about choosing a career, and although it had nothing to do with eating disorders, it contained a great explanation of habits and why they make it so hard for us to change. Two sentences in particular made me think about the ways in which therapy only served to strengthen my habit at times. Dealing delicately and sensitively over a long period of time with things you want to change is nonsense. It doesn't work because you are giving much of your energy to dancing around with and empowering the old pattern. In therapy, I indeed empowered the old pattern. Therapy made me devote more time and thought to my binge eating, when I really wanted to devote less. Therapy made me focus attention on my bulimia and its supposed causes and triggers, when I really wanted to focus attention elsewhere. In this way, I believe therapy made the faulty brain pathways that drove my habits stronger when I really wanted to weaken them. By going to frequent therapy appointments, journaling, and analyzing my behavior, I only honed the neurological connections that supported binge eating. Therapy gave more life to my faulty neuropathways when I really wanted to destroy them. Therapy also taught me to connect almost everything in my life to binge eating. My past, my emotions, my daily stressors and problems, my relationships, and my personality. This only made me think about my eating disorder in many situations when it wasn't necessary. I didn't only connect my eating disorder symbolically to nearly everything in my life. Every time I decided that I binged because of a certain trigger, a social situation, a family problem, a negative feeling, I created a connection in my brain between the supposed trigger and the binge. When I again encountered the trigger, I automatically experienced an urge to binge by pattern of association. See chapter 35. Based on what I now know about the brain, it would have been much more helpful for my therapist to advise me to separate my bulimia from all other issues in my life, therefore allowing me to think about binge eating less and weaken the habit more. Although my therapist and the self-help books I read were all well-meaning, I don't think they led me in the right direction. It is possible that I am the one to blame for the failure of my therapy. Maybe I misinterpreted some therapy concepts so that I strengthened my habit instead of weakening it. Maybe I didn't do therapy correctly. Maybe I just wasn't good at uncovering and resolving issues from my past. Maybe I wasn't skilled enough at deciphering and coping with a multitude of triggers. Maybe I was too weak to give up all sugar. Maybe I didn't devote enough time to therapy goals because I had other things I wanted to do and had to do. However, considering the rather low success rates of eating disorder patients in therapy, I was not alone. Even though therapy does help some people overcome eating disorders, it was not the right path for me. Chapter 23. Revisiting Recovery. How did I do it? So far, I've explained why I binged, because of my urges to binge, why I had urges to binge, survival instincts and habit, and why I followed those urges. But how was I able to recover? How was I able to terminate all my binge eating? Since there was only one cause of each and every binge, urges to binge, all I had to do to recover was stop following my urges to binge. This was the cure for my bulimia, as I'll explain below. Once I binged many times, I created strong, organized neural pathways that automatically generated my seemingly irresistible urges. I've termed this my binge-created brain wiring problem. This problem was the physical expression of my habit in my brain. The more I binged, the stronger the neural pathways that drove my habit became, which prompted me to binge eat even more. Whether it was a habit of excess, a habit of pleasure, or a habit of impulsivity, or a combination of the three, my brain was just doing its job, maintaining the habit I had learned. When I decided to quit binge eating, I had a roadblock to face. I couldn't just say, "Okay, brain, I'm done binge eating, so turn off those irresistible urges." It didn't work that way. Once the habit was established, there was no way to turn off my urges except to retrain my brain. I had to reverse my binge-created brain wiring problem so that it stopped producing urges to binge. Reversing my brain wiring problem was quite simple. How did I create my brain wiring problem in the first place? By acting on my urges to binge many times. How did I reverse my brain wiring problem? By not acting on my urges to binge many times. It was straightforward. To reverse my brain wiring problem, to undo my habit, I had to stop following my urges to binge. That was the simple truth that often eluded me in therapy as I was focusing on the deeper emotional meaning of my binge eating. While I was in therapy, I held out hope that my urges to binge would just go away. Since I couldn't seem to fight them using willpower, I hoped that if I kept working in therapy, exploring the underlying issues and learning to cope with triggers, the urges would disappear on their own. They did not. No matter how much progress I was making dealing with emotional issues in therapy, my urges would never go away as long as I kept acting on them. As long as I continued following my urges, my brain kept strengthening the neural connections and pathways that produced them and strengthened the habit. The good news for me was, when it comes to the brain, what you no longer use, you lose. Not in a metaphorical sense, but in a real physical way. The brain is an extremely efficient organ. It builds and fuels the neural connections and pathways that are frequently used, and it weakens and prunes the ones that aren't. When a person stops performing a behavior, the neural connections that supported that behavior simply fade. In other words, if you don't exercise brain circuits, the connections will not be adaptive and will slowly weaken and could be lost. This was the case with my habit of binge eating. From the first time I had an urge to binge and didn't act on it, I began teaching my brain that my habit was no longer necessary. In turn, my brain began to correct my binge-created brain wiring problem by weakening the neural connections and pathways that supported it, wherever the exact location of those pathways may have been. As I experienced more and more urges that did not lead to binge eating, my brain learned that I no longer needed the habit. The faulty neural pathways that once led me to the refrigerator weakened with a lack of use until they were able to carry signals no better than a frayed string between two tin cans in the old game of telephone. I couldn't teach my brain this lesson by arguing or trying to rationalize with it. I could teach my brain this only through my own repeated actions. In other words, I couldn't talk my brain out of my habit. I had to act it out. By not acting on my urges, I physically corrected my brain wiring problem. I had to make those willful behavioral changes, then my brain fell in line and turned off my urges to binge. Once I decided I wanted to take a different path than the one my brain had carved out for me, I, my true self, had to go down that different behavioral path before my brain. Then my brain followed, not the other way around. Rational recovery gave me a simple thinking skill that turned out to have incredible power. The power to rewire my brain, completely erasing my bulimia. I didn't realize it at the time, but I was actually utilizing the plasticity of my brain to end my habit. The same property of the brain, neuroplasticity, that created my habit completely erased it. This was possible only because of the capabilities of a specific region of my brain, the prefrontal cortex. The key to recovery, my prefrontal cortex. Whether my binge eating habit was a habit of excess, a habit of pleasure, or a habit of impulsivity, or, as I believe, probably a combination of the three, part of me still remained apart from it at some level. Otherwise, I would not have been able to put an end to the habit. The part of me that remained unaffected and directed my recovery was my prefrontal cortex. A brain region I talked about briefly when discussing the teen brain in Chapter 17. The prefrontal cortex, the most evolutionarily advanced part of the brain, that gives us our sense of identity and capacity for voluntary action, makes up the largest part of the prefrontal lobe. Compared to our animal ancestors, we have a very large frontal lobe, which occupies much more of our total brain than for any other creature. The frontal lobe has connections to other parts of the brain and can inhibit those parts, giving humans the ability to stop and think and divert primitive responses. Humans don't have to follow every impulse from their brains, and the prefrontal cortex is vitally important to this ability. The prefrontal cortex has the greatest role in inhibiting behavior and withholding automatic responses. The prefrontal cortex is the seat of the will, of freely performed volitional activities. In order to binge, I had to use willful, voluntary muscle movements, acquiring food, putting it in my mouth, chewing, and swallowing it, all of which my prefrontal cortex had complete power to stop me from doing. No matter what thoughts, feelings or cravings my animal brain generated automatically, I could choose my actions because of my prefrontal cortex. I could stop myself from performing inappropriate motor actions. My prefrontal cortex had this power because of its role as the brain's command post, chief executive, or conductor of the orchestra. The prefrontal cortex is the best connected part of the brain, meaning that it communicates directly with all functioning parts of the brain, including the animal brain. Since it is the agent of control within the brain and the central nervous system, its job is coordinating and constraining those neural structures. It was the prefrontal cortex that gave me the ability to say no to or use veto power over my urges to binge. Veto power is a type of willpower that psychologist Richard Gregory first called free won't. Without getting into a philosophical discussion of free will that is beyond the scope of this book, I'll say that free will does not necessarily work by initiating voluntary actions, but instead it works by allowing or suppressing those voluntary actions. In other words, we may not have the capacity to choose what actions the brain automatically prompts us to perform, but because of our prefrontal cortex, we can choose which of those automatic promptings to follow and which ones to disregard. When I stopped acting on my urges, I was using veto power. Without being able to describe the process at the time, I had in fact discovered the ability of my own prefrontal cortex to disregard my lower brain's automatic signals. I realized that, despite my intrusive thoughts, powerful feelings, and strong urges, my prefrontal cortex could indeed suppress inappropriate actions. I discovered free won't, the ability not to act, and by not acting over and over, I corrected my binge-created brain wiring problem. I believe that the prefrontal cortex is the specific region of what rational recovery calls the human brain, or the I, that gave me the ability to recover. It certainly wasn't necessary for me to know the technical details of my brain anatomy to recover. But now that I do know more, I can better explain how I was able to say no to each and every urge to binge. As I do so, I hope it will help others discover the power of the prefrontal cortex as well. 5 steps I used to stop binge eating. The next 5 chapters describe my recovery step by step. When I stopped binge eating, I was not consciously thinking that I was following a set of steps, but shortly afterward, I could look back and see exactly what I did that enabled me to use my prefrontal cortex to quit. Some of it derived from the advice I read in RR and some from my own insights. Here are the steps that corrected my binge-created brain wiring problem and brought my bulimia to an abrupt end. Step 1. I viewed my urges to binge as neurological junk from my lower brain. Step 2. I separated my highest human brain from my urges. Step 3. I stopped reacting to my urges. Step 4. I stopped acting on my urges. Step 5. I got excited. The first 3 steps made the 4th step possible, and once I practiced the 4th step for long enough, my urges to binge disappeared. The 5th step was a natural result of my success in resisting urges, but I believe it turned out to be very important to speed up and cement the brain changes that eased my habit. Brain over binge. Together, the 5 steps I used comprise what I mean by brain over binge, thus the title of this book. The concept is definitely an offshoot of mind over matter because it was my mind, my true self, my prefrontal cortex, my highest human brain, that had the capacity to override the harmful matter, my urges to binge coming from my animal brain. The prefrontal cortex lies structurally above and forward of over the animal brain. Therefore, my recovery was not only mind over matter, it was quite literally brain over binge. In the chapters that follow, I'll often refer to the five steps of my recovery as simply brain over binge. To illustrate this and draw the distinction between lower and higher brain functions, I will also begin referring to the animal brain as simply the lower brain and the prefrontal cortex or the true self as the highest human brain. This takes the two brain functions at work in bulimia down to their most basic forms. When I use the term lower brain throughout the remainder of this book, I am referring to the parts of the brain and nervous system that automatically produce urges to binge regardless of specific location. Like I have previously said, the brain and nervous system are not understood well enough yet to be able to pinpoint the specific regions and peripheral functions that create the urges. So even saying animal brain has been somewhat of a stretch. However, I can say with confidence that the urges arise automatically in regions of the brain and nervous system inferior to the prefrontal cortex, that is, in lower brain centers. I can also say with confidence that the prefrontal cortex, the most sophisticated and highest, in ability and mostly in anatomy, part of the human brain, gives us the capacity to override the automatic impulses from the lower brain. This is why I will keep things simple, talking about just the lower brain versus the highest human brain. Chapter 24, Brain Over Binge, Step 1, View Urges to Binge as Neurological Junk. In order to stop acting on my urges to binge, I had to see them as essentially meaningless. I could not hold on to the idea that I somehow needed to binge for this or that reason, or that my urges signaled an emotional need. I had to view the urges as junk, and only junk, emanating from the depths of my brain and not worth any further consideration whatsoever. As I've said, therapy concepts and secondary benefits were some of the reasons I followed my urges, and this step involved completely letting them go. If I would have held to the belief that I binged to cope with a life or some underlying emotional problem, I probably wouldn't have been able to stop so abruptly. If I had remained under the false impression that I needed to binge for some mysterious psychological reason, then I would have taken that as an excuse to continue my behavior indefinitely. I was fortunate to have the experience with the medication Topamax that temporarily alleviated my urges to binge. Nearly 2 years prior to my recovery, Topamax taught me that the problem wasn't my life or my inability to cope with it. It also taught me that without urges to binge, I didn't need the secondary benefits of binge eating, nor did I want them. When my urges to binge temporarily subsided while on the drug, I didn't feel a need to be sugar drunk. I didn't feel a need to be temporarily numb to my problems. I didn't feel a need for the pleasure that binge eating brought me. This information was invaluable to me when I finally recovered, since I knew my urges to binge weren't symbolic indicators of what I truly wanted or needed, physically or emotionally. And since I knew I could easily do without the secondary benefits of binge eating, it was relatively easy to start viewing the urges as neurological junk from my lower brain. I could clearly see that the urges were merely products of my binge-created brain wiring problem, completely apart from the higher self, which brings me to the second step in recovery. Chapter 25, Brain Over Binge, Step 2. Separate the highest human brain from urges to binge. My urges to binge weren't truly mine. I was not my habit. I wanted a better life than stuffing large amounts of food in my mouth and then desperately purging to undo the damage. I had goals for myself that I knew were inconsistent with my eating disorder. I knew I wanted a real life, but my habit kept me trapped in destructive patterns of behavior. Part of me, the seat of my consciousness and identity, knew binge eating was wrong, and that part of me regretted each and every binge. That part of me was my highest human brain, my prefrontal cortex, my true self. Ego-dystonic urges. Rational recovery introduced me to the idea that there are two separate brain functions at work in addictions. In the case of my bulimia, there was my lower brain, which involuntarily generated my urges to binge, first due to survival instincts, then due to habit, and my highest human brain. My urges to binge were ego-dystonic, meaning that they seemed apart from and at odds with my intrinsic sense of self. My true self's desire was to be healthy, but my urges to binge interfered. I first learned the term ego-dystonic about a year after my recovery, while reading about a study of patients with obsessive-compulsive disorder, OCD, directed by neuropsychiatrist Jeffrey Schwartz. This study shows remarkable similarities to how I stopped my bulimia, and it explained to me how my recovery was possible and why it was permanent. Like bulimia, OCD is ego-dystonic in that sufferers have intrusive urges that they feel driven to follow. They have reoccurring obsessive thoughts and feelings urging them to repeat the same compulsive behaviors. For example, hand-washing, which are akin to the intrusive, reoccurring thoughts and feelings that drive a bulimic to binge. Like bulimics, those with OCD feel that the urges are apart from their true selves, and they know rationally that they shouldn't follow those urges, but they can't seem to resist. For example, an OCD patient who has urges to repeatedly wash his hands knows quite clearly, in a part of his mind, that his hands are not really dirty. This is because in OCD, the faulty brain connections that give rise to the obsessions and compulsions spare some of the patient's brain. The spared brain regions are the most sophisticated and evolutionarily recent parts of the brain, located in the prefrontal cortex. In other words, the highest human brain is spared in OCD, just as I believe it is spared in the habit of bulimia. My urges to binge were not a function of my highest human brain, regardless of exactly where and how the urges arose in my lower brain. It didn't matter what neural pathways drove my habit. My habit remained separate from my highest human brain, and my highest human brain remained capable of resisting the urges, even if a habit of impulsivity, see chapter 20, was the primary mechanism, meaning some circuits in my prefrontal cortex indeed weakened through lack of use in resisting the urges to binge, my prefrontal cortex was still distinct from the source of the urges, and it still remained capable of learning to say no and therefore strengthening. In Schwartz's OCD patients and in my case as a bulimic, the core reasoning power and sense of identity remained largely intact. There were two competing systems of brain circuitry. One system generated the faulty brain messages of OCD, or in my case, the intrusive urges to binge. And the other was the patient's mind, the prefrontal cortex, which remained capable of overcoming the faulty brain messages. Put another way, the lower brain and the highest human brain competed in my bulimia. When I didn't know this competition was due to two separate brain mechanisms, it was nearly impossible to resist my urges. Experiencing urges in a new way. It wasn't until I separated the most sophisticated and most uniquely human part of my brain from my urges, and really felt that separation, that I felt capable of saying no. Separating my urges to binge from my highest human brain was so important because it allowed me to experience those urges in a completely different way. It allowed me to see that they were just automatic functions of my binge-created brain wiring problem. I learned to recognize any thought or feeling that encouraged me to binge as something completely apart from my true self, as merely a product of the habit. This immediately made my urges to binge less threatening and gave me the sense that I was above them. I was able to look at my lower brain from a distance, so to speak. Each time I experienced an urge to binge, I was able to monitor what was going on in my brain and observe what I was thinking and feeling. I felt I could float above my lower brain and look down on all the thoughts and feelings encouraging me to binge, all the while viewing those thoughts and feelings as neurological junk, I was able to see clearly that my urges to binge were not an indication of any real needs, but merely an indication that my brain was on autopilot, trying to maintain my habit. I was able to disconnect from those thoughts and feelings and not get so wrapped up in them. A side note about anorexia. The ability to separate oneself from urges is not as easy when it comes to anorexia, which is why I believe that it can be more difficult to treat. In anorexia, resistance to eating is not ego dystonic, but ego syntonic, meaning it is usually what the anorexic's true self wants to do. Anorexics, at least in the early stages of the disorder, rarely lose their appetite. Rather, they willfully refuse food and feel successful, powerful, doing so. Indeed, when I was caught up in restrictive dieting, it was hard for me to see that what I was doing was wrong. I wanted to lose weight, and that's what I was doing, so I didn't see why it was a problem. My extreme appetite, on the other hand, I could definitely see why that was a big problem, because it was so out of line with what I set out to do, lose weight. I think this is why anorexics are usually not as motivated to overcome their problem as binge eaters, because that would certainly involve gaining weight, and often a significant amount of weight. This resistance to weight gain and lack of motivation to change makes anorexia more dangerous and deadly than bulimia. Furthermore, if the willed starvation continues long enough, anorexics eventually do lose their appetites. A starvation habit, which could be called a starvation-created brain wiring problem, sets in, so that eating normal or even small amounts of food feels downright wrong. Anorexics can then follow their starvation habit right to hospitals and, sadly, even to the grave. Indeed, anorexia has the highest mortality rate of any psychiatric disorder. Despite health consequences, the anorexic's ego-syntonic drive to be thin makes them feel they are doing the right thing, whereas in the case of a binge eater, it is easier for her to see what she is doing as abnormal and thus separate herself from it. Mindfulness and the power of attention. I found remarkable similarities between the way I separated myself from urges to binge and the process Schwartz used in his study. Specifically, Schwartz taught his OCD patients a skill called mindfulness, which is essentially the practice of observing one's inner experiences in a way that is fully aware, but not judgmental. You stand outside your mind, observing the spontaneous thoughts and feelings that the brain throws up, observing all this as if it were happening to someone else. Schwartz thought that experiencing brain-generated OCD urges with mindfulness, the calm clarity of an external witness, could strengthen his patient's ability to resist them. Without knowing the name of that thinking skill, I was using mindfulness to experience as my urges to binge with detachment. Schwartz believed mindfulness could help his patients because they could use the healthy part of their brain, their prefrontal cortex, to observe their own symptoms, which would give them an impartial, detached perspectives on their own thoughts. He hypothesized that mindfulness, which puts mental space between the will and the unwanted urges that would otherwise overpower the will, could empower the prefrontal cortex to resist the urges. Indeed, the prefrontal cortex is capable of resisting urges to binge, which brings me to an important implication of this step. I had to view my prefrontal cortex, my highest human brain, as extremely powerful, as fully capable of standing apart from and resisting any urge. If I saw my highest human brain as being on the same playing field as my lower brain, there is no way I could have separated myself from my urges to binge. But viewing my urges as neurological junk and my highest human brain as the powerful seat of my true self allowed me to put brain over binge. With this mindful separation and distance in place between my highest human brain and my urges, I was able to stop paying attention to them. Attention, as it turns out, is vital to neuroplasticity. When we focus attention on a particular task or on an aspect of the external environment, or on an internal state or sensation, the brain actively, physiologically dedicated to whatever we focus on is amplified. So it was that when I paid attention to my urges to binge, the neural firing that produced them increased. And when I stopped paying attention to them, the neural firing decreased. Since neuroplasticity depends on the repeated firing of neurons, paying attention actually strengthened the neural connections and made the habit stronger. And not paying attention weakened the neural connections that comprised my binge-created brain wiring problem. Indeed, attention exerts real, physical effects on the dynamics of the brain and can direct neuroplasticity. My attention, unlike my automatic urges to binge arising in my lower brain, was something I could control. Brain scans have shown that people can willfully change the amount and quality of attention that they focus, and this in turn changes the brain. I could willfully direct attention away from the urges and onto anything or on nothing at all, and this acted back on my brain to gradually erase my habit. This doesn't mean I was always able to completely shut the urges out of my awareness, but awareness is different than attention. For example, I'm aware of lots of things going on around me right now as I type. Music on the baby monitor, the humming of my refrigerator, an occasional drip from my leaky kitchen faucet. And I can be aware of random thoughts popping into my head about things I need to do. But I am not putting conscious effort into thinking about those things. I am not paying attention to those distractions. It was the same with my urges to binge. They were certainly in my awareness when I first quit, but I did not turn my mind toward them. And this is what I mean when I say stopped paying attention to my urges. Separation techniques are not new. Employing separation techniques in the treatment of eating disorders is not unique to this book. The idea of separating the true self from the eating disorder is rather common in the eating disorder community today and is used in some traditional therapies. Women with eating disorders often give their disorders names and personas of their own. Anorexics sometimes call their problem Anna. Bulimics call their disorder Mia. And women with all types of eating disorders call their problem Ed, a play on the abbreviation for eating disorder, ED. Ed has become more popular since the 2004 publication of Life Without Ed by recovered anorexic and bulimic Jenny Schaefer. In the book, Schaefer describes how she pictured her eating disorder as an abusive husband named Ed, living in her own head, whom she had to divorce in order to recover. Others have called their bulimia the monster, picturing it as an evil brute living inside them. Whether she calls it Ed, Anna, Mia, or the monster, the woman envisions the creature persona as separate from her true self. The creature persona has a personality of its own. It has thoughts, feelings, and desires that are not normal or healthy and that supposedly cause the woman to perform eating disordered behaviors. In order to recover, the woman must defeat the creature or persona. Although separation from the disordered thoughts and feelings of bulimia or BED is indeed desirable, there are 5 main problems with the way separation techniques are used today. 1. Current separation techniques are unrealistic. It can be very difficult to convince yourself that there is a monster, an evil woman named Mia, or an abusive man named Ed living in your head. Even though the characters are just metaphors and can be useful for some people, many simply can't embrace the idea of these characters seriously. It can be quite a leap for some people to think that their urges to binge are manifestations of a foreign personality who wants to see their demise. On the other hand, it is fairly easy to see bulimia or BED for what it really is, a habit, a physical expression of a binge-created brain-wiring problem. It's not a monster. It's only neurons firing automatically because of repeated binge-eating. It is not an abusive husband. it's the lower brain doing its job to maintain a habit. But for those who like the idea of giving their bulimia, or BED, another name, if it helps conceptualize the fact that urges to binge are not really the true self, then great, so long as the eating disorder sufferer always remembers that Ed is the binge-created brain wiring problem, not to the I, but also not a being with bad intentions, not a malicious or abusive ogre aiming for her demise. Ed is only doing his job, driving the bulimic to maintain the habits she's created. She has taught Ed well, and now he automatically does what he's been taught. 2. Current separation techniques allow the avoidance of responsibility. Ed made me do it. This can become the motto of someone who uses current separation techniques. When a woman separates her true self from Ed, she may feel that she is at the mercy of Ed and so can blame him for her actions. This does not help the woman assert control over her problem. It only helps her assign blame to something other than herself. In short, it can help her avoid responsibility. I'm not claiming that Jenny Schaefer's Life Without Ed does this, because it is indeed a powerful story of someone who stood up to her eating disorder and took back her life. However, it is possible for a woman to use the persona of Ed Mia the Monster to avoid accountability for controlling her own behavior. The binge-created brain-wiring problem, or whatever term is used for the habit, has no ability to control the binge eater. Her ability to make conscious choices and to control voluntary muscle movements is unaffected by bulimia and BED. The habit cannot make her go to the refrigerator and put food in her mouth. It can only urge her to do so. 3. Current separation techniques require unnecessary battles. Imagining an eating disorder to be an evil persona, a monster, or an abusive man living inside your head means you have to believe you need to defeat it. In my opinion, this causes unnecessary battles. If the bulimic believes Ed Mia the Monster is out to get her, it follows that her job will be to counter the attacks with attacks of her own, with fighting back. As already discussed, fighting with urges to binge is useless and can therefore make the bulimic even more frustrated, more angry, and more tired. In the long term, it is simply an ineffective strategy. Not only that, but such battle tactics are likely to make the urges stronger, consequently making the bulimic more prone to follow them. Why? Because by fighting the urges head-on, attention is being turned to them, and this gives them strength. As I talked about earlier, when you focus attention on urges, it amplifies the neural firing that produces them. This, in turn, makes the neural connections that produce the urges even stronger. By fighting with the urges to binge, you are telling your brain to sharpen its awareness of that urge, to pay attention to it. And this only serves to make the urges stronger and the fight more difficult in the long run. It is a fruitless war. You cannot simply argue your way out of urges to binge. The thoughts and feelings are so automatic that no matter what rational reason there is for not binging, the brain will produce a compelling counter-argument. Further, it's nearly impossible to lay out a convincing argument to Ed when part of the bulimic fully agrees with him. I believe it's much more useful to listen to the lower brain's seemingly logical reasons to binge without giving those thoughts any mental focus. This means not fighting with thoughts and feelings, not white-knuckling, not arguing with a fictional mental character. This means not giving urges any attention and simply letting them come and go instead of allowing them to draw you in. This means creating as large a gulf as possible between the highest human brain and the urges. 4. Current separation techniques do not draw the true self disorder separation line clearly. Another danger of current separation techniques is that too many problems, thoughts, and emotions are often assigned to the character persona, A woman may begin attributing all her negative thoughts and feelings about her body and all of her food issues to Ed, Mia, the monster. For example, she could imagine the monster to be behind any craving for sugar, whether or not it's a craving to binge. She could assign all anxious and depressive feelings to Mia, all negative body concepts to Ed. This can cause constant confusion about who is talking in your head. It is very possible to lose the abilities to trust one's own thoughts and recognize one's own voice. This is why, in this book, I want to draw a very clear line of separation. Your urges to binge are on one side of the line, and you, your true self, your highest human brain, are on the other side. Sure, there may be some problems on the you side, such as low self-esteem, perfectionism, anxiety, body image and food issues, and it may be desirous to change some of those things. But to start, the binge eater needs to stay focused on the one problem she's trying to solve, clearly drawing the line between her urges to binge and herself. 5. Current separation techniques can be too playful. Bulimia and BED are dangerous and potentially deadly disorders. And giving the problem a playful name or persona doesn't capture its seriousness. Some women who binge say that the disorder becomes their friend or becomes like a child or pet they need to nurture. Giving the habit a playful name can sometimes contribute to befriending or nurturing bulimia or BED. In reality, bulimia or BED has no personality. It is an automatic function of the lower brain. It is not the bulimic's friend. It is holding her back and endangering her life. Chapter 26. Brain Over Binge, Step 3. Stop Reacting to Urges to Binge. Once I separated my highest human brain from my urges to binge, it became possible to stop reacting to my urges, meaning that I stopped letting my urges to binge affect me emotionally. Until I separated from the urges, I was emotionally overwhelmed by them. I let them make me mad. I hate having these cravings. Frustrated. I am doing everything right in therapy. I can't believe these urges aren't going away. Depressed. Poor me. I want to eat so much, but I know I shouldn't. Anxious. I'm scared that I'll binge tonight. Desperate. I need to binge now. Or, when I was on the brink of giving in, excited. I can't wait to eat. Reacting emotionally only gave my thoughts power, strength, and the ability to influence me. When I let my thoughts and cravings make me mad, frustrated, depressed, anxious, or excited, I allowed them to take over my whole body and state of mind, and usually led me right to food. However, after I separated my highest human brain from my urges to binge, I stopped paying attention to these thoughts and feelings, and I therefore became emotionally numb to them. With a distance between myself and my urges to binge, I could experience them as if they were playing on a tape recorder, as if they were not my own thoughts and feelings. They were only the results of neurons firing down the well-worn pathways in my lower brain, and they didn't have any power to affect me. Once I stopped relating to them, my urges to binge stopped upsetting me. As long as I stayed apart from my urges, they had no power over my emotions, and I no longer had to fear them. I could experience them without it being a big deal. I could go on with life, do what I needed to do, despite of those little buzzing thoughts and feelings encouraging me to binge. I didn't need to get upset that my urges were there, because I knew they would burn out before long. When I say I stopped reacting emotionally, I don't mean I was always able to control my emotions, nor was I trying to. Indeed, emotions, which originate in lower, more primitive parts of the brain, cannot always be controlled and are often resistant to higher-order, rational thought processes. I didn't try to rationalize with or will my emotions away. I simply changed my perspective so that the harmful emotions naturally settled down. I didn't tell myself, "Don't get mad at the urge," because angry feelings sometimes arose beyond my control. Instead, I visualize distance between myself and my urges so that they no longer had the power to make me angry. I didn't tell myself, "Don't be depressed that you can't binge," because depressed feelings